Okay, well done, and slight little problem with the sound, but look, your sound came through wonderfully. It was very good. Enjoyed that. We haven't had music for a while, but we're going to make up for that at the feast, I believe, because, well, we got to have music just about every day, so we'll have people up there helping out and performing. So thanks for that. Duncan, for your part in that. Appreciate that, and again, all the best to you. The ecstasy of victory and the agony of defeat. You saw it this week. You've seen it several times, more than once if you've watched the Olympic performances. You've seen these sporting events many times. The winner is happy. That's an understatement. The winner is generally out of his mind with elation. The loser is sullen and morose, sad, sometimes angry, and finally brings himself to come around and congratulate the winner and become somewhat, as much as he can, gracious about losing and in defeat. Some are genuinely so, but you can see how they feel. Defeat's a bad word. Failure is worse. That should not be applied. Sometimes people remain devastated, vowing to come back next year. It's inspiring to see the young people, however, well-trained athletes, what they can do. Some of these sports I have participated in only in a, well, not in a very good way, but I have. A lot of you have. But nowhere near to the level of these Olympians. Their performances are truly astonishing. Some are absolutely beautiful. They show extraordinary development of the human body and development of one's personality. There is one aspect of the game, however, that diminishes the enjoyment, and that is the intense competition. The Australian swimming team generally brings home a bucket load of medals. This year, only one gold. And a couple of others. Australia was 19th in the world in medals until this past week, and a lot of those races were lost by, say, a hundredth of a second. Let's say a couple of them. Actually, not a lot, but two of them were. The press made the point they thought others wanted to hear how bad it is to lose, and by such a small margin, or by a simple mistake after all that work. One of the contestants rightfully took the press to task, telling the press, you know, a lot of us don't feel bad about getting silver or bronze. It's you guys who are making a big deal out of it simply because that's the way the thought pattern goes, or at least so they think, and it's been promoted. The camera captured the bewilderment and disappointment in the face of the losers. It was sad to watch the South African in one of the four by 400 heats, where he was going to participate, I believe, I think, in the third leg of the 400, and he had no legs. He had prosthesis, but he was going to run, and he was equal in ability and speed as any of the other runners, and his teammate was tripped coming around the corner to hand off the baton, and that team was just sort of left. Nothing they could do. He was injured. He couldn't get to them to pass off the baton, and that was the end of it. And you could feel through the screen the terrible disappointment of the person who, after all of that training, after bringing himself back up from, you know, in this terribly handicapped situation, now performing not in the handicap Olympics, but in the real Olympics, not able to do that. That's quite extraordinary, simply missing out. The media focused mostly on the winners, who smile broadly, but for every winner, many more go home from the games disappointed. That's the inevitable downside for the majority of the participants. So they put the medal tally on the board all the time. I heard that this was not a principle of the Olympics. but it's what the press does. It's what television does. Everyone wants to know how they did. And in the end, there is one question that is asked. You know what that question is? Who is the best? What country is the best? As determined by the medal count. Australia was doing a beat up on itself about how bad it was doing in the medal count the first week. Normally ranked about fifth, certainly ahead of Great Britain, yes. Australia, small Australia, with a population of only 22 million, ranks as high as the best of them. Not this year. Have you ever wondered why the question is continually asked, who is the best? I want to pose that to you today. The question seems innocent enough. Who's the strongest? Who is the fastest? Who is the richest? Who is the smartest? Who is the handsomest? We have so-called beauty contest to choose. Who is the best? Miss Universe. Who is the perfect one? Who has all the wonderful qualities? But to determine who is best at anything requires competition. And competition soon turns people into adversaries. Striving to be or perceived to be the best makes this world what it is. And I will tell you that it's a hard place, this world, where the vast majority don't make it in the sense of living up to whatever they want to have in life in terms of their material possessions or the kind of life that they would like to have. They look through a window, as it were, glancing upon or observing those who are more fortunate, as they would put it, those who live in a better country, a better place, who have done better. Who will win this World Series? Who will win the Super Bowl? Who will win the Premiership? The greatest prize is given to who is best. Satan wants people to ask that question. Who is best? He wants us to ask who is the greatest. And we do. We ask it regularly. The world revolves around the idea of who is the greatest. Muhammad Ali came right out and said it. He was the best. And Usain Bolt says, "You're looking at a legend." Yes, he's really taken with himself. This is what he's into. This is what it's about. Nations ask that question. And when they ask that question, war is the result. Nazi Germany is the most recent in memory. Maybe, well, there are others, of course, but the one that perhaps comes to mind, and it's very, very clear that this is what it was all about. They knew they were the best. They didn't like their previous experience of losing in World War I. They didn't like the humility of the reparations that the world imposed upon them. And they knew they were the best. They were better than anybody else. The super race. And they had a right then to defeat all those who disagreed. Therefore, we should rule. And there was one person who came to be the head of all of that, of Nazi Germany, who espoused that idea. We say, well, we don't see that today. We say the person at the top, sometimes, well, he must be the best. He is the most expert. He is the one who has the best leadership qualities. My father-in-law would say, and I've heard him say this more than one time, if a person is that smart, he would be smart enough not to want to be prime minister. They knew they were the best, better than anybody else, the super race. All right. This was his way of saying that those who get to be prime minister or president of a country is not generally the smartest person or the most qualified. Now, Jesus said that in the time of the end, Nations will rise against nation. Kingdoms are groups of nations against kingdoms. Matthew 24:7. And that when the competition to be the best becomes deadly, Jesus called it tribulation. Nation will rise against nation. It's going to be a time of terrible tribulation. I've got a very simple proposition for you today. Competition is not of God. It's not of the devil. It is of the devil, rather. Competition is not the best way. It has been said, competition brings out the best in people. It forces you to do better. Without competition, you can never reach the greatest heights. And this is why we have competition. What makes a person the greatest? He beats them all in competition. It's the only way to know. You have to have competition, it is said. Once again, the proposition today is very simple. All of this is a myth. It's been foisted upon a world, and the world revolves around this idea that you have to have competition. It happens in countries you see it in the quest for gold at the Olympics, but the communist world wanted to prove, and they have wanted to do this for 50 years, to prove their system was the best. It would produce more of the most accomplished athletes and more of them. They just want to. It's a matter of their pride. Our system, what we do, our race, sometimes the way we govern ourselves, must be the best. After all, look what it produces. Look how far people have gone. Is this true? They will go to great lengths, spend a lot of money to produce that. They will produce the best army, the best armament, the best cities, the best this or that. They don't understand that they're in a totally wrong and terribly destructive track that is going to end up in the terrible things that are going to happen in this world in the end time. But I would like to ask this question. Where did all this start? For man, it started in the Garden of Eden. Genesis chapter 3, verse 5. I think it's very clear. In his own words, we read, Genesis 3, 5. For God knows that in the day that you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. In verse 6, so when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. What was wrong with what they already knew? What was wrong with what they would learn from God? As they had already learned a lot from God and promise of a great deal more. Why? I'll tell you what was wrong with that. You couldn't be the best. You couldn't get on top and stay on top. You couldn't be as God or like God. That was the issue here. There was more to be had. There were greater heights than you could achieve if you went the way that the devil was espousing. That's where it started for man, but it started long before then. Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12. How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer? Isaiah 14, verse 12. We've read these scriptures also in Ezekiel 28 many times. How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How are you cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations? I thought that was very interesting here. What can the nations actually be and become, and what can they have under God's system? We're going to be talking about this in the Feast of Tabernacles. How far can a people go? What can they have? what can be enjoyed, what way of life is so great and wonderful, far better than what we have today, and competition will not be a part of it. The philosophy and the idea of the devil has weakened people, not strengthened them. It has decreased their performance and has detracted from any good success that they could have. Again, that's the proposition of the sermon today, that competition is not of God. It is of the devil. Let's notice what else he says. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. He's going to reach greater heights than what he had. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farther sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Does this sound like competition to you? It does to me. It sounds like he's in competition with somebody. Turns out he's in competition with God. Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit. Well, that's the way God says it will happen. And if you follow that principle, you're not going to win. People think they do, but they don't. This is the principle that the world operates on today. Ezekiel 28, verse 12. Son of man, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre, and say to him. Now, the previous reference to the devil, it was the king of Babylon. Now, he's using kings here, because kings would exalt themselves. And the way they got to be kings is what they killed everybody else, generally. And they were ruthless. And they were in competition with other people for the position that they have. And then they became in competition with other nations or empires around them, is the way it is. And so you have an approach here, a frame of mind on the part of two rulers then, and it then glides or morphs very easily into the attitude of Satan, the devil. And so you have to understand typology in the Bible by in this way. A lot of people say, well, he's a type of this and he's a type of that. Well, why? Well, it's because there are certain likenesses or correlations that you have to follow through. And so this is why he uses this. And it's quite usual to see this done in the Bible, all throughout the Bible, both Old Testament and New Testament. So he says, first of all, for the king of Tyre, and say to him, thus says the Lord God, you were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. He's obviously here not talking about a person, but a person who himself likes to think of himself in this way. You were in Eden. Now we know that's not him. The garden of God, every precious stone was your covering. The sardis, topaz, diamond, beryl, onyx, jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and so on. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes were prepared for you in the way that you were created. You might think that was enough. You were the anointed cherub. This is an angel who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created. He was a created being. Till iniquity was found in you. Why did it turn to iniquity? I don't know that we've analyzed this far enough to try to get to the actual bottom of it. We say, well, there was a certain vanity. He was taken with himself. It was pride. This was sin in this sense. Let me make this statement here. And I hope as we discuss it today, you will see the truth of this. What was the issue here? What was the issue? Let me make the statement very clear. The thing was, he didn't do it. He was created this way. He was given this. You might say, what's wrong with that? It's not good for a mind who is developing other things or that's going on. I have everything I have because of you. What does this make me? Now, that's not a very good way of looking at it. You know, in the end of the day, everything we have is given by God. Oh, we're supposed to work hard. But let me tell you about the gift of eternal life. What about that? Tell me about earning it. Can't happen. What about the grace of God? Grace means gift, something freely given. Are you going to say, wow, I would like to be a part of earning that? Why? Because that's the way I would like to think of myself, of having some part in this. Now I'm being given this. Don't know if I go for that. So he entered into competition with God. He wasn't who he was because he competed with someone else to get it. God gave it to him. That's terrible. Now, it's very interesting when you go back and you take a look at the religion of Judaism, where when Jesus Christ came along and he says, all the things that you're doing mean nothing. You're just trying to be something. You're in competition here with everybody else, and you have established yourself as the one who has prevailed in righteousness. And so it carried on over to as to how they would be seen by men. They made broad their phylacteries. Jesus Christ wouldn't have one bit of it. They were in competition. And Paul dealt with this subject over and over again, the book of Romans, the book of Galatians, the book of Colossians, the book of Philippians, where else? All throughout. He dealt with the idea of people who became who they were through their competitive efforts against one another and against everybody else. Their pride, their vanity, and what they wanted to have. And it became an exclusive thing. It was. They were a very small sect or group within Judaism. And their religion was terrible. They were competitive, you know, up to their Adam's apple. And Jesus Christ saw it. And it didn't help anybody else. It didn't benefit anyone else. They were able to acquire a position. This is what Paul was into. The Apostle Paul was into this. And when he met Jesus Christ on the road to Damascus, and he did meet him, he understood. He understood almost immediately that everything that he had been a part of was for his gain, was for himself, who he could be. Now, I gave a sermon on that, was it 2 weeks ago, on the Apostle Paul, as to what he was into, what he was really about here. And people tend to think, well, he thought he was really serving God. No, he wasn't. Please, don't go down that track. He was not, didn't have in his mind think he was really serving God. That was only a ruse or a guise. It was an excuse to promote himself because he was a part of a religion that did that. And so the righteousness of the Jews, as Paul speaks of, it's what it was. It was their righteousness, their goodness. And so I simply want to point out here that this is what's behind this. Could a person be content with the fact of what God would grant him, that God would impute his righteousness to the person, that God would forgive with no strings attached? Could a person be happy with that? Yes, they could be. Could a person do better with that? It is my proposition today that a person would do much better and achieve much better and much more by going down that track and long in the long run, ultimately be so much better off than to be out here in the world, in the herd, in the competition, as it were. Doesn't work. Now, people think they're doing the right thing. They think that's the way to go. Our thoughts of jealousy, envy, lust, wanting more, comparing ourselves among ourselves, even anger, rage, pride, are thoughts and feelings that come from competitions. Do you have it? It's in everybody. We are in competition with a person next to us from the day we're born. Two children playing. Do you see it there? who's gonna get the toy that they're playing with? Who's gonna get the position on the swing, you know, the one they want? Who is going to get the attention of mom? Sit next to someone at school, you are in competition. And there is a grading system to prove who is the best. And there are a few who come out always the best. They're the sharp ones, or so we think. They are the ones who are, let's say, the achievers. The others are just, they're just content with who they are, and they're looked down upon and judged as such. Some don't make it in school. Some don't make it at all. Some make it later outside the system. I'll talk about that in just a moment. Those most successful do make it outside the system. They make it better than those who stayed in the system. You can name them. And they don't get out and mix it up with anybody else necessarily. They don't follow the herd. Bill Gates, richest man in the world, drop out. I'm not encouraging you to drop out. I don't want you to get me wrong on that one. I'm just simply telling you. There is a little bit another way that bears analysis. There are a number of people who have done this, and if they would have stayed with the crowd, you better think where they would be. I know a number of people who, just simply on a human level, a physical level, who simply didn't go along with the crowd. And they are so much better off than they would otherwise be. Now, I hope we would give that consideration here. So how are you to fight, and how are you to run your race? How are you to fight your battle, and how are you to run your race? Does that mean you don't have to fight a battle and you don't have a race to run? No, it doesn't mean that at all. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, 23. But let's analyze it closely as to what it says here. 1 Corinthians 9, 23. Now I do this for the gospel's sake, that they may be a partaker of it with you. Oh, well, that's an interesting statement. We're going to come back to that. Verse 24. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. So there's the word compete. So what's wrong with that? It says it right here in the Bible. Everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Well, you got to understand what we mean by this. It says here in verse 24 that all who run, that run in the race, they all run, but one receives the prize. That's in the Corinthian games that they had, and that's in the Olympics. Only one winner. There are not a lot of winners, though I would suspect that if you did reach that level, you would be a winner, and they try to say that. He says, run in such... He doesn't make the correlation that the race that we are in has only one prize and only one person's going to get it and everybody else is left out. This is not what he's saying. What he is saying is that we should take a lesson in what they do to obtain a perishable crown, and we do the same, so that we all may receive the crown that he has for us. We all have to do that. So we should then be temperate in all things. That's a good point. Think about that. One is temperate in what he eats, what he drinks, or he drinks, how he conducts himself, how he disciplines himself with his own rest and health. So you're going for a prize. You better do that in such a way. You better show a certain amount of discipline in how you pursue this imperishable crown. He says, therefore, I run this way. Therefore, I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus, I fight, not as one who beats the air. So I do this with purpose. I have a purpose. I want to get the crown. He is not saying, I want to be the only one to get the crown. He is not saying, I want to be better than somebody else who also may finish the race, but I want to be ahead of them. This is not what he's saying. Everybody has to run his own race. I hope that principle will come through as we discuss this. He says, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection. What does your body want? It wants you to feed it with its lusts thereof, whether it's alcohol or whether it's food or whether it's a sexual appetite or whether it's drugs of some that the body can demand certain things. Yes, it can. He says, I discipline my body. I bring it into subjection. He makes it very clear as to the kind of life he will live. He says, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. So you use all the principles that those in the Corinthian games would use, as athletes themselves would do today. For what reason? For themselves, a perishable crown, where only one gets it or only one wins. Now, what he said, and I said this, I read this at the beginning of this passage here. He says, I do it for the gospel's sake, that I might be a partaker of it with you. Notice that. For the gospel's sake, that I may be a partaker of it with you, is the point. Not that I can exclude you, but be with you. Did you know that the competitive spirit was in the church in Corinth? So Paul has to explain this. This is why he explains this. You ought to tie this in with the basic idea or premise that started the whole letter to begin with. You do have to work as hard as if you were doing it yourself. You train the same, but for what reason? Not so that you can come out in front, but that all may finish the race. We'll read that toward the end. There was that competitive spirit there. And some people were put down and they were not treated equally. He says, when you come together as a church, why do some are hungry? Some of the more disadvantaged among you go hungry. How can this possibly happen? And that, of course, was what was taking place. There were cliques, terribly cliquish church. They were lining up behind various so-called leaders. There was competition here. This is what he's dealing with in the church. And so he follows through with it in several different ways. Oh, they were doing it in a number of ways. Eating meats offered to idols. They didn't care. Some were more righteous. You had a number of situations there that all demonstrated that what we had here was a competitive spirit that developed. It was brought right on over into the church as to who was who. Who was important? Who was in? Who was liked? It's not good for a group of people. That's not the way God operates. I'm going to show you this is not the way God operates as we go along. But he says, I do this for the gospel's sake, as it says in verse 23, that I may be a partaker of it with you. Now let's go back to verse 19 a little bit further. He says, for though I am free from all men. That's interesting. You'll see how that plays into it in a moment. I have made myself a servant to all that I might win the more. You mean if you are a servant, you will win more. I think that's just what he said. Now, that doesn't make sense. You got to be out for yourself. You got to play hard. You're playing against the other person. That's the way you win. That's the way it's understood today. That's not what he says. To the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law. And not being without law, of course, toward God, but under the law toward Christ, that I might win those who are without law. Now, all of this was for the sake of somebody else here, and not for himself. Verse 22. To the weak, notice, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. You got no guarantees that all will be, of course, but that is all those who are there. But now this I do for the gospel's sake, again, that I may be a partaker of it with you. Okay. I think we see a little bit better picture here, don't we? As to Paul's approach. What does it mean to become weak, as he said here? Let's say you're in a race and you're going along, and let's say you're winning, but kind of over your right shoulder or so. Depends, I guess, which way you're running. You look around and you find somebody stumbles. What's the pack going to do? Leave him behind. That's his problem. But let's say you stop and you help the person up and you get him on his feet, dust him off a bit, so to speak, make sure he's steady, and you stay with him and he runs to the end and he finishes. To the weak, I became weak. That's what that means. I just put it in some practical term or way that maybe we could perhaps understand this. That where everybody needs to finish. We are not in a race where one person is a winner and only one person. All are winners who run in this race. It's not going to be, it's not a matter of who is going to be the greatest in the kingdom or who is going to be the greatest now. That's what the world is made out of. And we need to think about which direction we're going to go in life. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15, very quickly. I use this about every third or fourth sermon because I think it's very, very powerful here, especially in this context. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. The love of the Father. What's the love of the Father? What does the Father want for you? What is he doing for you? What has he done in by way of his tremendous humility to make sure you are going to make it? That's the love of the Father. The love of the world is not that way. For all that in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever. Now, that's the real winner right there. You just can't be a part of the world. How did Paul become great? Was Paul great? Paul was great. I think everybody understands that. One of the greatest servants of God. He speaks of himself as the one who worked harder than the rest of the apostles. He never considered himself to be higher than them. But he didn't. He understood he wasn't a whit behind them in any case. How did Paul become great? Very simple. By trying not to be great. Very simple. Luke 22:24. Now there was a dispute among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. And he said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors." That's a slam, by the way. In other words, this person was a ruler, and I will benefit you because I am a ruler, therefore give me your support. I will give to you what you need. They were called benefactors. Okay? It is through my granting your needs because of my authority and position. Oh, that's what that person was in there all about. It was their authority and their position. But they would be the greatest. But not so among you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he who governs as he who serves. For who is greater, he who sits at the table or he who serves? Is it not he who sits at the table? Yet, he says, I am among you, as the one who serves. As the one who serves. And what do you mean by that? You are great by helping others to achieve their goal. That's where greatness comes from. The greatest person must be one who is serving others by assisting them to cross the finish line. Not trying to be first. You know, there's an idea that was expressed back in the parable of the workers of the vineyard, remember? Where some worked the whole day and some only came on in the 11th hour, and they were all paid the same. And Jesus Christ made a statement that perhaps makes more sense now if we understand it. The first shall be last, and the last shall be first, he says. The workers in the vineyard didn't like the idea that those who work the least will also get paid the same. Everyone crosses the finish line. This is God's economy. This is the way he's doing it. Everybody's going to finish there. All right. So this whole idea, who's the best now? Who's the best in the kingdom? Futile discussions. Absolutely futile. And have no part of what God is doing. God puts everyone in the body as he pleases for the work of service, as we're told. What's that work of service? If it's not there to assist others to get into the kingdom of God, if it's for them to achieve their goal, well, I'm going to tell you something. That person is not doing his job, and he won't be in the kingdom of God. I'll say that over and over again until we really understand it. That our purpose is to assist and to help others achieve the goal that God has for them. That's our greatest purpose. If you're out here trying, well, I've just got to make it. And I've really got to make it. Let's notice what Paul says, 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 6. For I am ready, already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. 2 Timothy 4:6. Verse 7. I have fought the good fight. Indeed, you have to fight a fight. He says, I have finished the race. Notice how he puts it. I finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day. And not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing. He wasn't out trying to beat somebody else. That was not in his mind. It was a matter of competition. You know, the servant who in Matthew chapter 25, I want you to notice something here. And this is totally different than what you see today in the Olympics or any sporting events in the world, in business, or anybody, anywhere where this whole thing is based on the concept or the idea of competition. He was told, well done, wasn't he? The servant whose talent gained 5 was told, well done. Both made it. No competition here. You run your own race. And if you express God's, and you express God's mind as a part of it. Matthew 25:19. After a long time, the Lord of those servants came and settled accounts with him. And so he who had received 5 talents came and brought 5 other talents, saying, Lord, you delivered to me 5 talents. Look, I have gained 5 more talents beside them. The Lord said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of the Lord. But just get across the finish line and there is joy in the Lord. You don't have the agony of defeat if you didn't quite make it first. This is different than what you see in the world. The same with the 2 talents. Verse 23. One had 2. The next one had 2. Very good. He increased 2 more. Not as much as the other one, but he did. He says, well done. Enter into the joy of the Lord. He didn't say, you can be happy, but not as happy as the other guy. I think you're getting my point here, aren't you? All right. But I simply want to point out here that we do have some, hopefully, we don't have misconceptions, and we'll get around that. But it's kind of easy to really get mixed up in this. I want to read to you something I've got. It's a person by the name of Max Kalehoff took notes from a Stanford University lecturer, a guest lecturer who didn't, I think, over 20 lectures on a similar subject, but he was in business and he covered this particular subject here on the idea of competition. The lecturer was Peter Thiel, who is an entrepreneur, a capital venturist. He is a philanthropist. He gives away a lot of money, but he's made a lot. And he gave these lectures. Now, you can actually tune in, you can read them, but they're too long and to even get into. But there's this one here that I thought is excellent. Now, I want to give this to you. I want the young people to consider some things here because it can guide you in your life. It can guide you in how you may do things, how you may view things, because we do have a lot of feelings of insecurity, do we not? Why do we have that? The world is a competitive world. there's a lot of type of comparisons that goes on in our minds, naturally. And it's not easy. Now, you need to break out of that. You really do. And look at things a little differently. Let me just give this to you. Picture a herd of buffalo racing toward a half-empty watering hole. Each buffalo is competing to get a sip before the entire herd arrives and to drink it dry. Now consider the lone buffalo that says, well, I can't read what it says here, but he says to the rest of you, boom, all right, and runs in the opposite direction where he believes there is another watering hole with no competition. The lone buffalo takes on some risks and parts with the crowd and scores a monopoly on a new watering hole. He fully quenches his thirst and lives on prosperously. The competitive herd is in all of us. Foremost, competition is a coveted cultural value. It is embedded in our educational system, our sporting traditions, our consumerism, government and world politics, and of course, our digital marketing industry. In business, this was given in San Jose, by the way, at the Silicon Valley, and where Stanford University is. In business, competition is considered good. A market's products get better. Prices come down. Product categories swell and become massive. Consumers win. Markets win. The problem with embracing competition is that competition itself becomes the end game. We compete just to compete, not some other higher outcome. And that is according to storied entrepreneur and investor Peter Thiel, who expressed his belief in a startup class he's been teaching in his alma mater, Stanford University. One of his students, Blake Masters, has been posting excellent summaries of Thiel's lectures. Masters summarizes Thiel's views on competition. But too often, in the race to compete, we learn to confuse what is hard with what is valuable. Intense competition makes things hard because you just beat heads with other people. The intensity of competition becomes a proxy for value. But value is a different question entirely. And to the extent it is not there, you're competing just for the sake of competition. Competition is not only a poor proxy for value, but it can be highly demoralizing. Masters reports on Thiel's referencing elite students. Top high school students who arrive at the elite universities quickly find out that the competitive bar has been raised. But instead of questioning the existence of the bar, they tend to try to compete their way higher. And that is costly. The rationalization that is actually inspiring to be repeatedly beaten by all these high caliber people. We should question whether that's right. Instead, Thiel suggests disregarding competition and establishing a totally new market and owning it, or as he calls it, a monopoly. It's about working smarter, not harder. It's about creating your own new playing field with its own new rules. Instead of blindly embracing competition, you might be better off evaluating the world based on a scale of competition versus monopoly. And deploy, I don't mean to game monopoly. I mean, you go your own single way. You think about that one. And deploying your resources accordingly. In some cases, perhaps it makes more sense to compete and continually raise the standard bar. In others, a better outcome may lie in defining an entirely new category, outcome, or success measure, one that nobody else is pursuing. The monopolistic path is more sophisticated and a contrarian one. It is difficult to embrace because it's counterintuitive and requires introspection, confidence, a leap of faith, as well as money, time, and a host of other things. It requires unlearning the deeply embraced notion that competition equals value and subjecting yourself to ridicule and risk. But it also holds the highest rewards, ones that are usually unachievable by clawing your way continually to the top. Whether you're in a position of leadership or simply calculating your own professional path, it is helpful to realize which road you're on and consciously navigate it. Are you competing with a herd or thinking freely and creating your own monopolistic outcome? I can remember a man a long time ago, heard him on the radio. He says, you just can't believe everything people tell you. And if you do, you're going to be like everybody else. You're going to have to break out of that. And that's why the church came, one of the reasons why we have the church today, because people said, yeah, I don't want to be a part of that same herd, the same thing everybody else does, and get in competition with everybody else in the herd. He says, you don't have to go that way. Walk away from it. Be different. And he got a whole church to be different. I'm not saying that was the only factor, but that's one of the basic ideas he continued to put across. Here's another little one I found. Competition as a crutch. We often point to competition as a tool to bring out the best in people. You will run faster or work harder or fight more ferociously if there is someone breathing down your neck or a record to be broken. The problem with competition is it takes away the requirement to set your own path, to invent your own method, and find a new way. When you have competition, it's the pack that decides what's going to happen next. You're merely trying to get or stay in front. Competing with yourself is more difficult, requires more bravery, and leads to more insight. This is some very interesting things here, but I just want to ask you, is competition the best way? Does it get the best results? My contention, and I hope that you'll agree that the Bible also says it is not. But that's the way of the world. And what we have in the world today is so inferior to what you read in Isaiah, the second chapter, about the next world, about the thousand-year period. It's so inferior to the 11th chapter of Isaiah, or the fourth chapter of Micah, where you have a picture that is so absolutely wonderful, where people have reached such heights of prosperity and plenty and goodness and just happiness in their life, if I can use the word happiness, but blessedness, I think, is a better word, simply because there's a whole different philosophical economy that we're dealing with here. Okay. Now, can this be broken out of today? Now, when you run the race, you indeed must run. No question about that. And only he who runs will have the reward. We have that particular servant back in Matthew 25 that I didn't read for you. He didn't even get in the game. He didn't even decide to run. He just sort of buried the talent. Well, he was given a different path. He wasn't given the herd mentality path, or to go the way everybody else. He was given a different path, but he never even did that. That was a problem. You do have to fight. You do have to run. You do have to exercise discipline. You're going to have to do that. God doesn't exempt any of us from that at all. But can you come out? Revelation 18, verse 2. And he cried mightily, Revelation 18, verse 2. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become the dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. All the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. This kind of paints a little picture here. Only the few are going to be benefited by this great system called Babylon, which we're in now, by the way. So many people are not being benefited and will not ever, under the system we have today, be benefited and blessed by what we have. The few will, and you better know how to work the system. You better be in the herd, and you better be in the front. That's a hard way of life. God says, don't be a part of it. Verse 4, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, meaning don't be a partaker of her sins. Don't go down the same track, and lest you receive of her plagues. For her sins have reached into heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. We've got a whole system here. People kind of think Babylon is a conglomerate of nations. No, that's the beast. Forget that. Babylon is the system. Revelation 18 describes a system where it says the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. Luxury here is a term meaning such extreme wealth, not just ordinary wealth. I'm talking about extreme wealth, totally beyond what anybody should have or even think about, and unnecessary for that matter. And the few have it. The few have it. And as the system progresses, there will be fewer who will be in control. And the vast majority will have less. And so the Bible says there will be famines, and there will be disease, and there will be pestilence. And you wonder why in the midst of such wealth. This is a system we got here. Babylon is a system that is based upon who can be at the top and who can stay at the top. And they have used the methods. Every system has methods. Let's understand these things. And if you're going to succeed in the system, you must abide by those methods. And some people have learned it very well. And that's where they are. And he says to you, you come out of that. Okay. You cannot share in her sins. Render to her, because of the people who have been hurt by this. Render to her, just as she rendered to you. Repay her double according to her works. And in the cup which she has mixed, mixed double for her. And in the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow. For she says in her heart, I sit as a queen and am no widow, and I will not see sorrow. But God has something to say about that. It's a terrible system. And people think it's going to be a wonderful system. You can follow God's system that has behind it the give way. Okay. Ecclesiastes 9:11. I returned and saw under the sun, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happens to them all. Why? Why? Is competition the best way? You can be the best, you can be the most qualified, but you may not win the race. You are not guaranteed. You run God's course. That's what the word race means. You run God's course, and you will finish the course. You run with God, you will finish the course. And there is a course to run. Acts 20:24. But none of these things move me, for I do count my life dear to myself, so that I may finish my race with joy. And the ministry which I received from the Lord Jesus to testify to the gospel of the grace of God. Hebrews 12:1. Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Each of us has our race. God's mind is that you help others achieve God's goal for them. This makes you a success in God's eyes. The more you help people, the more you're going to achieve for yourself. Let each of you look not only for his own interests, but also for the interest of others. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit. Okay, here we have here. I want to read to you finally a chapter from 1 Corinthians chapter 3, if you want to follow along with it here. I want to show you the difference. And there's a key here, so important. But that you are going to go only as far as you help others go. Okay? Here's one of the keys. Brethren, I would not speak to you as spiritual people, but as to carnal and to babes in Christ. I fed you with milk, and not with solid food, for until now you were not able to receive it, and even now you are not able. For you are still carnal, for where there are envy, strife, divisions among you, are you not carnal and behaving like mere men? And let's consider competition. This is what we're talking about here. For when one says, I am of Paul, and another, I am of Apollos, are you not carnal? Who then is Paul, and who then is Apollos, but ministers through whom you believed, as the Lord gave to each one? We have a different economy here. That's what the Lord gives. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So then, neither he who plants is anything, nor he who waters, but God who gives the increase. So now he who plants and he who waters are one. And each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor. Not that he does in competition, but that's what the reward is there for. His own labor. And what does he do? For we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field. You are God's building. According to the grace of God, which was given to me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds on it. For no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ, and of course the principles of Jesus Christ. Now if anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, you got to build on either of those. Each one's work will become clear. For the day will declare it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is. If any one's work which he has built on it endures, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned, he will suffer loss, but he himself will be saved. How are you going to be saved? Everybody has a work. And you're going to gain this as a result of how much you help other people gain what they need to gain. You're going to go as far as you help other people go as far. These are simple principles here. But that has to be a part of the whole mix in what you're doing. I want to skip down to verse 19. The wisdom of the world is foolishness with God. For it is written, he catches the wise in their own craftiness. And again, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they are futile. Therefore, let no one boast in men. But no one boast in men. For all things are yours. How wonderful that can be. All things are yours. Whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or things present or things to come, all are yours. And you are Christ, and Christ is God. How can it get better than that? I simply want to leave this with you for something to think about as a new way. Don't allow the world, no matter how great it seems, to take you away from a whole new way of life that God has introduced for us, and one that he's going to have in his next world, his next age, and in the kingdom of God.